Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey, I'm Dr. Michael Hunter, forensic pathologist from Autopsy, Reels Channel's medical mystery series on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. Be sure to download the Podcast One app and subscribe. Then go to Reels.com, that's R-E-E-L-Z.com, to find more programs like this one on Reels Channel.
One of rock and roll's most distinctive voices has been silenced.
Roy Orbison died last night near Nashville after suffering a heart attack.
The Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter was 52.
Roy Orbison was one of the most influential rock stars of the 20th century.
He was not anything like his contemporaries.
Famed the world over for his soul-searching songs.
Elvis was crazy about Roy's voice. He would say, "That's the only guy that can outsing me."
I sing what I like to sing and write what I like to write.
With hits like Pretty Woman and Crying, his career spanned 30 years. He was on the road almost nonstop.
He lived to sing. That was what his whole life was about.
But it was a life overshadowed by heartbreak.
He had just gone through the death of his wife and then was faced with his two sons dying in a fire.
And on December 6th, 1988, at just 52 years old, he died way before his time.
I could not fathom that happened. It stunned me.
Roy Orbison's death certificate says that he died of a heart attack. But a heart attack can have many causes. Roy had just completed a sellout, 28-day tour, and looked to be in good health. I want to find out why he died so suddenly at just 52 years of age.
World-renowned medical examiner and forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Hunter has performed around 5,000 autopsies, collaborating closely with law enforcement and other forensic specialists. His pivotal role in investigating suspicious cases has revealed the truth behind mysterious deaths for over 20 years.
These are documents relating to Roy Orbison's death, and together with other information I've seen and firsthand accounts, I'm going to examine every aspect of Roy's life to find out what really led to his premature death.
November 10th, 1987. The Mean Fiddler, London. 1 year and 1 month before Roy Orbison's death. Roy is coming to the end of a 28-day tour playing to capacity crowds. And almost two decades since his first hit, his records are topping the sales charts once again.
John Kruth, biographer.
This was his grand comeback, and I think that he was as amazed as anybody else. Roy was just so happy and grateful. A younger generation was now embracing him.
This photo was taken only 3 weeks before Roy's death. He looks healthy, not too overweight, and I can see no physical evidence of illness. However, when rock and roll stars die early, many suspect illegal drugs or alcohol abuse. So I want to investigate to see if this could have caused Roy's untimely death.
Terry Widlake, road manager.
Roy's lifestyle was
Joe Milson.
Always seemed strange to me, being who he was and what kind of profession he was in. He didn't drink. He wasn't into drugs. He didn't even smoke wacky weed, which really surprised me.
Joe Milson, friend and songwriter.
This is the only time I've heard Roy taking any kind of dope or pot. So he said, I smoked one. And the next day, I was going to Nashville. He said, the highway went up in the air, and I went up with it. And he said, man, he said, that's the last time I'll ever take a dope, any kind of grass or weed or anything. And as far as I know, he never did.
It seems Roy didn't succumb to the usual rock and roll temptations, as I can find no evidence of him taking illegal drugs or drinking excessively. So I'm going to discount this as being a factor in his death. At this stage, however, I can't rule out any other addictions Roy may have had.
Roy Kelton Orbison was born in Vernon, Texas in 1936. His father was an oil worker and mother a nurse. Living through the Great Depression, Roy and his brothers were desperately poor.
Roy grew up in a tank. He lived in an oil tank. They cut out windows and doors in it. And the family lived in there.
Food was very scarce. They had little or no food to put on the table.
They sometimes depended on handouts, even from Roy's childhood sweetheart, Claudette.
She would make a seed cake and bring it to him. And he would take it home and put it on the table, and the whole family was able to share it because they had no other food in the house.
The effects of poverty was a big spark for him to live the American dream and become something and go for it.
The one thing that young Roy and his family did have on their side was a love of song and music.
His father played country music with a couple of his uncles who would come over and pick, and Roy heard that as a kid.
Yes, I started singing when I was about 6 or 7 years old. I fell in love with it straight away, fell in love with my voice.
Within a few years, Roy was singing on local radio and TV shows.
Roy was about 9 or 10 when he won a talent show. Actually, he had to share the $15 with another kid, and that was the beginning of his professional career.
By 20, he had signed his first record deal. Songwriter Joe Milson was an early collaborator with the awkward and shy young man.
A lot of people made fun of him, but I loved that voice, and to say something, I'd say, you know, don't make fun of him. He's going to be a big artist one of these days.
4 years later, in 1960, they scored their first hit. Showcasing Roy's unique rock and roll crooner sound. Only the Lonely topped the charts all over the world. The poor boy from Texas was now on the road to becoming one of the biggest names and highest earners in the business, with estimated sales of 50 million records and almost endless tours on both sides of the Atlantic. He struck gold as one of the first rock and roll stars to sing about male heartache and loneliness.
He had a natural proclivity to be this sensitive guy. Besides, women love that kind of sensitivity. He, I think, understood that, but most men were afraid to show that, to be the guy who was crying.
As distinctive as Roy's songs was his appearance.
Looking at early photographs of Roy, I can see that he was very pale-skinned with light hair and glasses. There were rumors that he was albino and blind. Albinism is an inherited genetic condition affecting the production of melanin. That's the pigment that colors the skin, hair, and eyes. Related conditions that produce albino symptoms have been associated with heart problems. So I'd like to explore these rumors about Roy further.
You know, I was real careful with Roy. I never talked about his looks. I tried to just cover over. I said, man, you look all right. I said, All they're going to listen to is your voice one of these days. You don't have to worry about that.
The rumor of him being albino was totally ridiculous, but he was kind of pasty.
I can find no evidence that Roy was albino or blind, but I have read that he was concerned about his unusual appearance and set about changing his image.
He dyed his hair black. It had been kind of this mousy, washed-out, dirty, dishwater blonde. And that was a really cool move.
The dark glasses came because he went on tour, and he lost his eyeglasses. He couldn't see good. So he found these dark glasses, put them on. People said, "Roy, you really look good like that." He said, "You think so?" And so that became his image.
Dr. Linda Papadopoulos, psychologist.
At the time that Roy was growing up, it was a very hyper-masculine society, right? Roy's a really sensitive soul. So what does he do? He puts on dark sunglasses, dyes his hair dark, and, you know, takes on this sort of very brooding persona. And one has to wonder if that's not an attempt to try and hide that sensitive part. And literally, I kind of feel those glasses were almost part of that mask.
But shyness wasn't the only thing Roy was concealing. I've discovered that during the mid-1960s, he suffered profound emotional trauma and started taking sleeping pills to cope.
In December 1988, the rock and roll world was left in shock when legendary singer and guitarist Roy Orbison died at the age of just 52. Acclaimed medical examiner and forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Hunter is examining every aspect of the star's life to find out what led to his premature death.
When rock stars die unexpectedly, people often assume alcohol and illegal drug abuse to be the cause. But it's clear from the evidence of his associates that Roy hardly touched either. This doesn't, however, rule out prescription medication. And looking more closely at Roy's records, I've discovered that he started taking sleeping pills at the peak of his success in the 1960s. I want to find out why.
By the mid-1960s, Roy hadn't just achieved most of his musical ambitions. He was also married to his childhood sweetheart, Claudette, who gave birth to their three sons.
Claudette was Roy's muse. The biggest song that he ever wrote, Pretty Woman, was written for Claudette.
But while out riding on their motorbikes together in 1966, tragedy would rip them apart.
Harold Bailey, friend and musician.
They'd been on a motorcycle ride up East Tennessee, and on the way back, they were riding separately, hardly 4 or 5 miles from their house, and a pickup truck pulled out in front of them.
That was the love of his life, laying there on the road, you know, and it broke him up really bad.
Claudette, who once baked the cake that Roy took home to his starving family, was dead. A devastated Roy threw himself into his work.
He felt most at home on stage. He felt protected on stage and most at home on stage.
The idea that he's able to go back to work almost immediately after Claudette dies was a coping mechanism. This is not an indication that he didn't care or he didn't feel. Going back to creating music, to singing, to tinkering on the guitar would have been very therapeutic for him.
I've learned it was at this point, after Claudette's tragic death, that Roy started taking sleeping pills to cope with his loss. Sleeping pills work on receptors in the brain to slow down the nervous system to induce or maintain sleep. Taking them for short periods in response to a particular event or bout of insomnia is not a problem. But studies suggest that taken longer term, they can become addictive. And for people with pre-existing heart conditions, they can add extra strain on the heart.
Just 18 months after losing Claudette, Roy was confronted with more tragedy. September 14, 1968, Birmingham, England. 20 years before Roy's death. His three-month tour was coming to an end, and thoughts of home were on his mind.
He told me that I'm very excited about going home and seeing my kids.
Roy had three children. Roy Duane, age 10, Anthony, age 6, and Wesley, age 3.
Come in.
Hours later, Roy received devastating news. His house back in Hendersonville, Tennessee, had gone up in flames.
The press reported that the fire was started by the two older boys playing with a cigarette lighter, and that set the house on fire.
I'm so sorry.
Roy's parents and his youngest son, Wesley, survived the fire, but his two oldest sons, Roy Duane and Anthony, died.
It burned those two little boys down. There wasn't anything left of that house. It just burned it to the ground, man.
I don't think there's any doubt that Roy would have found the tragedies horrifically difficult to deal with. He'd still be grieving for Claudette, and he loses the children that they had together.
From reports, it's clear that after this second tragedy in his life, Roy was again taking sleeping pills. Since we know that Roy died from a heart attack, at this stage, I cannot rule out sleeping pills as playing a part in his death.
I think he pretty much relied on his sleeping pills. He told me he took them occasionally. I think he took them more than occasionally.
Something else that could have impacted on Roy's heart at this time was the sheer emotional shock he experienced as a result of losing three of his family members. The release of stress hormones immediately after such a shock can cause actual cardiac problems, known as broken heart syndrome, or stress-induced cardiomyopathy. This can cause pain and scarring in the heart, and has even been known to prove fatal.
October 1968, Hendersonville, Tennessee. Following the death of his sons, Roy returned to his hometown, and having lost his house, was staying in a motel. He became very depressed, stopped work, and withdrew from the world.
You know, strange enough, Roy didn't spill out his grief to anybody. He really didn't. I guess it hurt too much to think about it.
The coping strategies that we use them because they work in the short term, not necessarily because they're the best coping strategies. I think this is an indication that he didn't know how to effectively deal with how much he cared.
So did Roy suffer from broken heart syndrome? Biographical accounts suggest he didn't complain of heart pains at the time of his personal tragedies, and he lived on for another 20 years. Even if his heart had been weakened by these traumatic events, I do not believe it would have been the main cause of his death.
December 1968, Hendersonville, Tennessee. 2 months after losing his sons, Roy was paid a visit by his friend, Harold Bradley. He brought Roy a new guitar to replace one lost in the fire.
If anything was going to bring him out of it, it was going to be music.
Harold's kind gesture was just what Roy needed.
It was the best remedy for him to get back on stage and sing out that hurt and pain in his songs. You know?
Roy left his temporary home and began touring again, flat out, just like before.
I was very, very happy to hear that he was coming back.
The fact that he could continue was Olympian.
After his tragic losses, tender songs like Crying, with its longing lyrics, became all the more emotionally charged for Roy and his fans.
He deals with it very much in the same way. He just gets on with it. He kind of moves into his work again. Music, since the time he was a child, was in many ways his salvation, so he certainly wasn't going to let that go.
Can start me crying.
But 8 years later, at a show in Memphis, came an ominous sign of things to come.
Roy started to experience severe chest pains. I want to find out if these could be the first real physical indicators of what claimed his life so suddenly, just 10 years later.
When the legendary singer and guitarist Roy Orbison died in December 1988, family, friends, and fans were stunned. He was only 52 and seemed to be in good health. Renowned medical examiner and forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Hunter is looking into Roy's life and medical history to find out why he died way before his time.
Following the death of his wife and two of his sons in the 1960s, Roy had a lot to deal with emotionally and started taking sleeping pills, but he appeared to be in good physical health. I have now discovered that 10 years later, he started suffering from chest pains. I want to find out if these could have played a part in the heart attack that ended his life.
December 1977, the Liberty Bowl Memorial Stadium, Memphis, Tennessee. With public tastes changing, Roy's record sales have been plummeting, and he's having to play more concerts than ever to maintain his income. He suddenly experiences a pain in his chest, but ignores it and carries on with his tour.
Roy's entourage noticed he started complaining of chest pains. These aren't necessarily a sign of something serious. They can just be caused by indigestion, especially for singers who don't leave enough time between eating and performing. Some theorize that even singing itself can lead to chest pain. Roy was famed for the high notes he reached for when he sang.
Those songs are not the easiest song to sing. I don't know whether you're a singer or not, but hitting those notes, it takes a lot of energy and strength.
I'll give you an example. Elvis had Roy come and sing a single note on one of his songs. A single note, which they spliced in, because Elvis couldn't hit that one note.
The three-octave voice range Roy had was incredible. Most people could only stretch to two. Any increase in physical effort can put a strain on the heart. I'm not sure Roy's high notes were the primary cause of his chest pains, but if there were more serious problems with his heart, every time he hit the high notes, he would have been adding to the strain on it. And looking more deeply into Roy's medical records, I've now found evidence that he did, in fact, have a serious heart problem.
After several weeks of suffering with chest pains, Roy was so worried that he decided to seek medical advice.
I really think that he was in a bad way. He was getting to be in a very bad way.
From Roy's records, I can see he was told he was suffering from atherosclerosis, or blocked arteries in his heart. This would certainly have caused his chest pains. Atherosclerosis occurs when a fatty material called atheroma builds up inside of the arteries and narrows them, which restricts blood flow to the heart, which in turn limits oxygen supply to the heart muscle. Fatty atheroma buildup in the arteries can have a number of causes. One of the most common is an excess of fatty and sugary food and drink.
He wasn't brought up with the consciousness of eating salmon and quinoa. He was definitely a fast food guy.
One of the consequences of Roy being on the road away from home a lot was that he would often eat fatty and sugary foods at irregular hours.
Roy often ate late at night after his performances and maybe even skipped breakfast while resting the next day. Studies do suggest that not eating meals at regular times can lead to unhealthy snacking, binge eating, and weight gain. Roy's high cholesterol diet in these excessive quantities and at odd hours would definitely have been a major cause of the buildup of fatty atheroma in his heart.
We were at the Mayfair Hotel, which is where he used to love to stay in London. He said, I have to have something sweet. And I said, well, okay. So I call down to order the food. They don't bring you up a couple of cream cakes. They bring you up a whole two tiers of cakes. Did the show, came back. But guess what? The cream cakes are gone. All of them. His arteries were hardening, even as we were speaking.
Looking further through Roy's medical notes and from first-hand accounts, I can see there was another major contributor to the buildup of fatty atheroma in his heart. He was a very heavy smoker.
Roy started smoking when he was 12 and would later smoke at least 40 cigarettes a day.
I would caution him about his smoking, you know. I said, you need to take it easy, man. He said, I'm okay. I'm all right. I'm all right. And I said, well, you need to watch it because you're on tour a lot and you're smoking a lot. You need to kind of cool it.
Smoking is the biggest cause of fatty atheroma buildup, narrowing and hardening of the arteries. Left untreated, atherosclerosis, whether it be caused by diet or smoking, can kill. Roy's medical team clearly believed his case to be particularly severe because they advised immediate and extreme action.
January 17, 1978, Nashville Hospital, Tennessee. 10 years before Roy dies. He's undergoing triple heart bypass surgery.
Bypass surgery involves rerouting the flow of blood from the three clogged arteries that take blood to the heart with grafts that allow the blood to flow freely again. Life expectancy after a triple bypass operation is generally good, but Roy only lived for another 10 years. I want to find out why, in spite of his operation, he died at the age of 52.
I think that the bypass was a really good thing for him because he felt young and rejuvenated.
While Roy was feeling a lot better after the operation, he did nothing to change the lifestyle that had made it necessary. June 27, 1988, Nashville, Tennessee. It's 10 years since Roy's operation, and now just 6 months before his death. He's about to go into the studio to record what will be his final solo album and is running through his usual pre-recording routine.
He did everything wrong from the point of view of a vocal coach. A vocal coach would tell you not to smoke. A vocal coach would tell you not to drink soft drinks. And he had a thing for chocolate milk. He loved sweets.
Roy's triple heart bypass should have been a wake-up call for him. But he was still eating poorly and smoking.
Could Roy's failure to improve his diet, on top of his heavy smoking, have brought about his early death? Singer and guitarist Roy Orbison overcame childhood poverty and family tragedy. But no one was prepared for his early death in 1988 at the age of just 52. World-renowned medical examiner and forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Hunter is examining every aspect of the star's life to unravel the mystery of his early death.
I've been examining Roy's medical history. In the 1960s, following the deaths of his wife and two of his sons, he started taking sleeping pills. And 10 years before he died, he had a heart bypass operation following chest pains. The operation should have been a wake-up call for him to improve his lifestyle by eating healthy food and quitting cigarettes. But I've uncovered evidence suggesting he did nothing of the kind.
He was supposed to start leading this clean life, and I don't think he was making that effort too much.
If we look at the way that Roy deals with difficulties in his life, with the hard emotions. He very much, I think, tries to distract himself, to divert his attention. So he'll work very hard, or he'll sort of self-medicate with sort of tons of junk food or cigarettes as a means of escaping the pain that he felt.
Unlike many of his contemporaries, Roy wasn't hooked on alcohol or illegal drugs, but I do believe he suffered from an addiction of another kind. The cigarettes and junk food he loved all aided the release of pleasure-inducing endorphins in his brain. This could have become addictive. And his friends and associates say he got his greatest highs from performing live on stage. He literally couldn't get enough of this. So, even as he got older, he was always on the road. This leads me to ask if Roy's punishing workload was what ultimately killed him.
In his 30-year career, Roy hardly ever stopped touring. But in the mid-1980s, as a whole new generation of fans tuned into his early rock and roll sound, he agreed to multiple new tour dates.
He loved it. He loved the audience, and he just enjoyed performing.
Roy was a workaholic. He came from that background where we all identify with our work as who we are and what we are.
Summer 1988, Malibu, California. It's 5 months before Roy's death. He's being interviewed for Rolling Stone magazine about his newfound success and his membership of a new supergroup made up of George Harrison, Bob Dylan, Jeff Lynne, and Tom Petty, the Traveling Wilburys. In their hit song, Handle With Care, Roy's distinctive voice in the lineup was unmistakable.
Roy really liked that group. He said, I love that group. He sang with them. So they started cutting records. So he was on his way back up.
Roy was once again king of the hill, and enjoying all the trappings of success.
He appeared to be secure. He had a beautiful house in Malibu. He had rehearsal studios. He had all kinds of cars. He was traveling the world. He was Roy Orbison. He was a rock and roll legend.
But behind the scenes lay a more pressing reason for Roy's punishing new workload. While he never stopped touring for 20 years, his record sales were almost non-existent. But he still spent money like a chart topper.
His accountant, Bud Brown, told me on many occasions, please don't let Roy spend any more money. He's broke.
Ever since his 1960s heyday, Roy had been a big spender with a passion for flashy cars and a desire to provide lavishly for his family. Not only was he providing for his parents and his surviving son, he'd also married again. His second wife was a German named Barbara Jacobs, with whom he had two more sons, Alexander and Roy Kelton Jr.
Roy loved spending money. He was notorious for spending it. Part of that was because he'd experienced poverty. You know, he'd experienced restriction, and now he had money, so he could spend it. The other side, though, as well, is that spending was another way of trying to forget, you know, get as far away from this tragedy that he had early on in his life.
Many have assumed that Roy Orbison worked himself to death. But there is no evidence that working long days and hours in itself can directly cause death. There is evidence, however, that the unhealthy lifestyle associated with long concert tours like Roy's can be very detrimental to health.
December 4th, 1988, Front Row Theater, Highland Heights, Ohio. Roy is coming to the end of a sellout 28-day tour. It's now just 2 days before his death.
He was working harder than ever. He was making videos. He was touring. He had the Wilburys. He was at the top of the charts with the Mystery Girl album. And singing for people is what made him want to be alive. This is what fed him. This is what gave him life.
...9 p.m., December 6th, 1988, Hendersonville, Tennessee. With his tour over, Roy's returned to his former hometown to visit his mother, brother Sam, and son Wesley.
When Roy started a new family, Wesley, not surprisingly, was odd man out. He was from Roy's previous life.
They had been a bit estranged. He was determined to get back closely to Wesley.
This was a reunion.
I love you, Liz. I love you, Dad.
It was a return to the old days, I guess.
10:30 p.m. (clears throat) 10:45 p.m.
He's been gone a while now.
Sammy wondered whether Roy was okay and went and knocked on the door.
Roy!
And said, Roy, are you okay? And there was still no reply.
Roy!
Eventually, Sammy got in.
Roy! Come on! Roy, good boy! Come on! Roy!
11:30 p.m.
The ambulance couldn't find the apartment because the apartment didn't have a number on it. It's a very, very distressing event.
He's passed out. Go on, get in there.
When a heart attack occurs, time is of the essence. It's essential to get expert medical help as soon as possible. It was over an hour before Roy received cardiopulmonary resuscitation. This delay would have drastically limited his chances of survival.
11:50 p.m., Hendersonville Hospital, Tennessee. Roy is rushed into the emergency room, where doctors continue the battle to save him.
The fact that medics couldn't revive Roy suggests his heart had already stopped beating. His blood flow will have ceased and his body would have been deprived of oxygen, resulting in his brain being irrevocably damaged.
Nurse, check the pulse.
At 11:54 p.m., Roy Orbison was pronounced dead.
Roy Orbison has died of a heart attack in Hendersonville, Tennessee. The Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter was 52.
Roy said to me, when I die, I want to die like Elvis, in the bathroom. And that's exactly what he did. He died in the bathroom at his mother's apartment.
I could not fathom that happened. It stunned me. It made me sad because I was hoping that we'd get back together and recreate some of that beauty of beautiful music again, but I knew it was gone forever. When those words were said, I knew he was gone. That was gone forever. Forever.
Roy's death certificate says he died of a heart attack, but a heart attack can be triggered by many things. I know that 10 years earlier, Roy had a triple bypass. This can sometimes lead to a condition called restenosis. Restenosis occurs when the grafts used to create a bypass of blocked arteries fails, leading to renewed blockages restricting blood flow to the heart. This affects 20% of bypass patients in the United States. Without a full autopsy report, I can't confirm or rule this out in Roy's case. But looking through his other records, I have, however, made a surprising discovery, which could finally solve the mystery of Roy Orbison's premature death.
In 1988, Roy Orbison died of a heart attack at the age of just 52. 10 years earlier, he'd had a triple heart bypass and was expected to live a lot longer. Internationally renowned pathologist Dr. Michael Hunter has been examining Roy's medical history in an attempt to solve the mystery of his early death.
I've been examining Roy's medical history, from his early youth and family tragedies to his lifelong heavy workload, poor diet, and smoking. Looking at the immediate period leading up to his death, I've made two more significant discoveries. The first has to do with Roy's use of sleeping pills, which he started taking during the 1960s, after the death of his wife and two of his sons.
Harley Street, London, England. Roy battled with insomnia throughout his life.
He had dreams of losing Claudette on that motorcycle ride. And then, of course, he talked about dreams of losing his boys.
Worried about the amount of pills Roy was taking as a result of his bad dreams, Terry urged him to see a specialist in London.
He carried a black briefcase around with him. It was full of all kinds of drugs, prescription drugs, that he'd been given at one time or another. The physicians told him to throw all of his drugs away. So he ditched everything, including the briefcase.
I've discovered that despite Roy's assurances that he would stop taking all the medications, he did in fact continue to take the sleeping pills. And there is a possibility he was taking them right up until his death.
Most people never face the level of pain and tragedy that Roy Orbison went through. If he didn't rely on sleeping pills, he was some kind of superhero. And the problem is, of course, is that we all are become addicted to such things.
While Roy tried to move on from the tragedies that struck him in the 1960s, it seemed he was never allowed to forget them.
Maybe it was a television show that he was being interviewed on, and Roy would say, "I don't want to be asked about the death of my wife or the death of my children."
What was going on with what he'd experienced perhaps hadn't been resolved. We know that sleep disturbance comes with conditions like depression. In his case, one has to wonder if, you know, when he got home at night, if all of that pain and emotional turmoil just never really allowed him to ever rest again.
Sleeping pills can be problematic for people who've suffered blocked arteries and heart failure, as Roy had. They dull the sleeping body's ability to recognize the buildup of fluid in the lungs that can result from this condition. This causes breathing difficulties, which would normally force someone to wake up, change position, or take medication to alleviate the symptoms. Using sleeping pills, Roy would have put an enormous strain on his heart and lungs by not recognizing and responding to that fluid buildup. But as serious as Roy's sleeping pill addiction was, I think it was something else that finally pushed him over the edge via terminal heart attack. Here are two photos of Roy, one taken a decade before his death and one just weeks before. You can see he's lost a substantial amount of weight in the second one. I've discovered Roy's weight often fluctuated throughout his life.
August 1988, Roy's house, Malibu, California. In his final months, Roy was urged to lose weight for his latest comeback tour. He hired a personal trainer and started doing workouts, probably for the first time in his life. For most rock stars, performing live on stage usually provides a thorough workout, but not for Roy.
His style of not moving on stage and being very static was very much a Roy Orbison trademark, almost. Roy's energy was sporadic. Sometimes he would lay in bed all day until it was showtime.
After nearly 30 years of touring all over the world, Roy found no time for exercise. Combined with his junk food diet, this meant he always struggled to maintain a healthy weight.
Anecdotal evidence suggests that in an attempt to control his weight, Roy would go from binging on junk food to periods of eating almost nothing. This is called yo-yo dieting. Yo-yo dieting puts an incredible strain on the heart, which over time can cause it to weaken considerably. This form of dangerous dieting on top of a sudden exercise program at the age of 52 could have been a step too far. Roy Orbison worked flat out to do the thing he loved most in the world, perform music for his fans. But years of neglect and caring for himself meant he paid the ultimate price. His poor diet and lifestyle, combined with his long-term use of sleeping pills, meant it was only a matter of time before his overworked and overstressed heart finally gave out.
I think Roy's legacy was that he came from a very, very poor family, and he rose up to become a first-class entertainer.
He was true to himself, and he didn't try to be somebody he wasn't. What you saw and what you talked to him about was what you got.
He overcame the hurdles that life threw him. That's the thing that was amazing about Roy Orbison. He wasn't just a singer. He was an Olympian spirit.
I think he'd like to be remembered as the artist he was, and that he was the only artist that Elvis Presley said could outsing him.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autopsy. Don't forget to subscribe at podcast1.com with the Podcast One app or at Apple Podcasts. Then go to reels.com, that's reelz.com, for clips, extras, and more from the TV version of the series, including reenactments and autopsy photos you'll only see on Reels channel. Find Reels on your TV at reels.com. I'm Dr. Michael Hunter.
In 1987, Anita Wiley disappeared without a trace. In 2020, DNA testing brought her truth to light. Truth Be Told presents She Has a Name, a new podcast about the disappearance of Anita, set against the backdrop of the drug epidemic in 1980s Detroit. Hosts Tanya Mosley and her nephew Antonio travel through Detroit to uncover the mysteries of what happened to Anita. She Has a Name tells a story of loss and redemption, mending broken family ties, and facing the trauma experienced by countless individuals who've lost loved ones to violence. Join Tanya and Antonio as they unravel the secrets of what happened to Anita Wiley. Listen to She Has a Name wherever you get your podcasts.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.